you like to make a call, please hang up and try again. If you need help, hang up and then dial your operator. Thank you.
And a very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Hook. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you on this Wednesday evening. Joined tonight by an echo. Hopefully somebody will turn that off. Joined tonight by Kyle.
Hey, Kyle.
And out there in Signal Land, we have Rob T. Firefly.
Good evening.
We have Gila.
Good evening.
And we have Alex.
You do? Good evening.
And Alex, I believe you should be the one to announce this news to people. Actually, we have some good news. If people could just stop what they're doing, because this doesn't happen very often. We have good news that we'd like to start the show with. Go ahead, Alex.
Yeah, it is one of those rare occasions where we're saying something optimistic, reporting on something nice, right? It's great to do that every once in a while. I feel like every decade we get this opportunity. Well, it's my absolute pleasure to tell everyone tonight that's been following the story so closely for so many years now, and this goes back 6 years, goes back to 2019, if everyone remembers, the story of Virgil Griffith, who was prosecuted by the U.S. government, a member of the hacker community, a member of the blockchain cryptocurrency community, I think one of the real higher-ups in the Ethereum Foundation, and somebody who's been part of the hacker community for how long, Emmanuel? For decades,
oh,
probably
God.
going on 30 years, right?
At least. All right, whoever's got the echo on, please turn it off. It's not our first day. At least 20 years, 25 years, or probably beyond that. That's how long I've known him.
Yeah, it's pretty extraordinary. So Virgil was very, very sadly incarcerated for, I guess, the last 4 years or so in change here, and it was for a conspiracy charge to violate the International Emergency Economic Powers Act. Essentially, what Virgil did was he went to North Korea and he gave a talk. He gave a talk that involved writing on a whiteboard and talking about technology. He talked about blockchain technology. He talked about things that were eminently Googleable, information that was available to the public, and he gave that information very freely at a talk. And he did all the right things that you're supposed to do when you go to a place like North Korea, a country that is sanctioned. And he self-reported to the U.S. Embassy that he went to North Korea when he came back to Singapore, because he, again, was this is somebody who is quite honestly, I digress for a moment here, and you can chime in about this too, Emmanuel, but Virgil, in getting to know him over the last several years, it's been extraordinary to become one of his close friends and allies, because he's quite possibly one of the most brilliant and most kind and most generous people I've ever met in my life. I mean, this is a guy that has a PhD from Caltech, of all places. Val Kilmer passed away last year. If anybody's ever seen the movie Real Genius, where one of Val Kilmer's great roles, I think, that is set really in a place that is supposed to resemble Caltech. You can imagine the type of mind that Virgil has. So I'll pass it over to you for a second, Emmanuel, if you want to talk for a minute about Virgil and his background.
Well, if you want another fictitious character, Sheldon Cooper actually went to Caltech and was a theoretical physicist there in Big Bang Theory. So, yeah, that gives you an idea of maybe the hostility that he felt in court, because people, judges in particular, felt he was a wise guy or smarter than them or just somebody who knew better. And in actuality, you know, Virgil, like me, sometimes can be rather naive as far as what people's motivations are. You might think people are helping you when they're not helping you at all. And in this particular case, I think he trusted our system much more than he should have. I went to North Korea, too. I went to North Korea in 2008, I believe, and broadcasted right here on WBAI. I have to say, you know, fear of condemning myself here, I think I helped the North Korean regime more than he did when I went over there. There was a day when it was April 15th, in fact. It was Kim Il-sung's birthday, and everybody went to see him lying in state in this massive building. And, you know, it was a big deal. It's like, you know, Christmas and 4th of July rolled up into one. And everybody, you know, no matter what you think of the regime currently, everybody bows down to Kim Il-sung, the founder. And so, you know, we had to literally do that as tourists, go in there and bow our heads. But on the way in, the door was coming shut, and there was a soldier who was also coming to do the same thing, and I opened the door and held it for him. That is helping the hostile regime of North Korea in the eyes of idiots who would think that anything you do that is somewhat kind or helpful is a crime. And you know, the thing that he was charged with, what you read before, makes him seem so guilty. Makes it sound guilty to you know, the average lay person who thinks North Korea is just filled with evil people. Yeah, anything you do, such as answering a question or holding a door, is seen as, you know, helping that regime. It's absurd. It's absolutely ridiculous. He should not have served a day in prison, let alone however many years of his life were taken by this. That's where the true crime is.
I think that's right. And I think we're in our digression, I think we possibly put the cart before the horse, so to speak, right? Because we haven't gotten through all the facts for the listeners, I think, that may not have the full story here. And so when Virgil went over to North Korea, and then he self-reported that he went there, he gave a talk, he did all the things that the State Department told him he should do if he goes to North Korea and comes back. And then the FBI wanted to talk with him, and he thought he was doing the right thing by talking with the FBI. And I think we all remember that night when he went and talked with the FBI, and then it wasn't a great thing, right? And then they wound up arresting him and prosecuting him for the transfer of knowledge to North Korea, or rather the conspiracy to transfer knowledge over to North Korea. And this was a prosecution in the Southern District of New York. This is a very, very difficult thing to fight. And the day before trial, there was a decision made that he should actually plead to the charge. And he pleaded to the charge to avoid going to trial. It was a very, very difficult and, I think, fraught decision for Virgil to make. And to see him actually plead to that charge and to allocute in court the very next day was, I could see it was painful for him to do that. Sentencing obviously doesn't happen right away. It happens months after. That was in September, I believe, of 2021. And sentencing was supposed to happen in December. During this time, Virgil was also already incarcerated in the MDC over in Brooklyn, the Metropolitan Detention Center. Not a nice place to spend any appreciable amount of time, of course. Then sentencing was kicked back to February. Then it was pushed back again to April of 2022, at which point Judge Castell of the Southern District of New York sentenced Virgil to a pretty harsh sentence. It was towards the lower end of the guideline sentence, but it's still a very, very harsh sentence for going over and speaking about technology. He gave him 5 years and 3 months. That's 63 months in prison for going over and talking about technology and a place where you're not supposed to talk about technology. Now, I do want to mention something about the government's case here, too, because people who hear this and say, well, it might be a very dangerous thing to transfer knowledge to North Korea, no matter how slight, especially if it relates to knowledge about nascent technologies, innovation, things like that that could be considered trade secrets, et cetera. Now, one thing I do want to mention, this is not something that has been widely covered or reported by the media in any respect, because it's a bit of a technicality, but I think it's an important technicality for everyone to understand. And that is that as part of the government's case, when they were preparing for trial, they made a stipulation to the court. And the stipulation, which is an agreement with the defense, the stipulation was to a certain fact that nothing that Virgil ever did or said while he was in North Korea at this conference in Pyongyang gave the North Korean government any additional knowledge or capabilities that it didn't already have. That's pretty significant. That's a significant stipulation. And you would think, well, why would the government make that agreement? Isn't that the whole case? Well, the lawyers in the Southern District of New York for the U.S. Attorney's Office, I have to say, are probably some of the best and brightest attorneys on the entire planet. They knew what they were doing when they made that stipulation, and they used it as a weapon by which they could prevent Virgil's defense team from introducing evidence at trial about North Korea's pre-existing capabilities. And so at that point, Virgil's ability to mount a defense becomes much more difficult because the judge agreed with a motion to limit the types of evidence that Virgil could put in front of the jury at that point about the pre-existing capabilities. But then you have to ask yourself, well, what the hell was this case actually about? If the government agreed that Virgil didn't provide any knowledge that benefited the capabilities of the North Korean government, what's the big deal? What's going on? Why did this case even happen? The case was sliced so goddamn thinly. And this is what people don't understand. The government's case was all about whether when Virgil spoke at that particular conference in Pyongyang, there may have been individual North Koreans that listened to that talk and learned something about blockchain technology and therefore could have been some kind of conspiracy to transfer knowledge over to North Korea. That's it, everybody. It wasn't about the government. Our government stipulated that Virgil did not provide anything to the North Korean government, yet he has been continually branded as some kind of North Korean sympathizer in the media over and over and over again, and very, very falsely and erroneously, and I would say maybe even defamatorily. But that's wrong. And so that's very important to know. So fast forward until last summer as well. I'll keep going in the story, the saga here. Years after that, my law firm and I had filed a motion, my old firm, frankly, to have Virgil resentenced on the basis of new federal sentencing guidelines that had come out fairly recently that applied retroactively to people who fit the bill as being very low probability for recidivism, that is, for being a repeat offender. And Virgil ticked all those boxes, and we suggested to the court that Virgil be resentenced. The Department of Justice opposed this motion, and they put in a very strong opposition to Virgil being resentenced to a two-point reduction, which is what the amount to which he was entitled based on these new guidelines. And it was an uphill battle because, quite frankly, the judge in this case, Judge Castell, who's a very tough judge, really didn't like Virgil. And we knew it was going to be like turning a tanker to try to win this motion. But we did win the motion. We won. And we had Virgil resentenced. And we took a little bit more than it was about 7 months off of his sentence, so a little bit more than 10% off of the entirety of the sentence. And that was a great day. It was a great victory. And that's what enabled the news today, which is that Virgil has come out of federal prison. He's come out earlier than we had expected, and he is on his way.
If I could just stop you right there. Okay. Is it you, Alex? Are you doing this?
Yeah. Do you have wired headphones?
Yeah, please put headphones on. You can't be listening to the show through your speakers.
Yeah, I'm trying to sort this out. I don't know why there's all of a sudden an echo.
Because you're listening through computer speakers. We just figured that out by looking at you.
But I've always been doing that for years.
All right, well, you've been covering up really well up until tonight, so please continue covering it up. What I'm trying to say is that Virgil should have been released last August based on what you just told us. I remember we talked about this on the airwaves. He was ready to be released based on that earlier sentencing guidelines, and even then they kept him until April. So it's really unconscionable the way they've treated him.
Well, in a sense, this was more of an administrative thing. He could have been released earlier had he chosen the halfway house that was available, that had spots, that had seats. Unfortunately, he had chosen Baltimore, and Baltimore was completely oversubscribed, and the halfway houses that were around that particular area had also been oversubscribed and may have lost their funding within recent years as well. So everything was really crunched up. But assuming that we didn't win this motion, then it still would have been quite a long period of time before he was able to have been released. So, yeah, it would have been nice if he would have come out earlier than today, but this was the date that they gave us, and they held to it. And so I think there's something admirable about that. There was always some kind of possibility that this could have been pushed back further, and it wasn't. So,
okay, but you know, I don't think we owe any thanks to people for just not torturing him more. You know, he should never have been in there in the first place. He should have been released last year. Should never have actually been sentenced in the first place. As you said, he simply gave a talk, a very basic talk. I mean, basically something a single line Google search would have told anybody. That's the extent of it. It's cultural exchange. And the real reason, in my view, he was in there in the first place is because Trump in his first term decided that he wasn't going to allow Americans to go to North Korea anymore. When I went, it was allowed, and I went as a European citizen too. So I was protected, but he went without getting the permission of the authorities here in the United States. And I think that was the big deal. I think that is what really upset the authorities, the fact that he basically didn't obey them. Is that accurate?
I don't think it's accurate, actually, because even though he could have been charged with the travel ban for traveling to North Korea, that wasn't one of the charges. That wasn't a charge to which he pleaded either. So I think he also had conversations with the State Department about going over to North Korea. And they were quite well aware that he may have been doing this. In fact, remember, Virgil was very upfront about all of this, even, I think, posted his visa online and the fact that he was going over to North Korea. And people had gone over to North Korea in violation of the travel ban as well and never received this type of treatment. The other thing that I think is really worth mentioning as well, and this goes back to the fact that Virgil is somebody who has very high academic qualifications. This is Dr. Virgil Griffith. We call him Virgil. He's part of the hacker culture, but he's also Dr. Griffith. This is somebody who studied long and hard for these types of credentials. And oftentimes when academics go to places, let's say you're an academic and you accidentally give a talk in a sanctioned country, or you know, accidentally is really, I think, maybe a silly word for this, but you go give a talk to people in Iran about, I don't know, something like hydrothermal energy or, you know, nuclear enrichment or something like that. And you say, I shouldn't have done that. You go and self-report to the U.S. government. Generally what happens is that if this is your first time doing that, especially if you have some kind of academic credentials, you would get what's known as a warning letter from OFAC, or the Office of Foreign Asset Controls, which is the U.S. agency that really deals with sanctions and sanctions enforcement within the United States. And you get a warning letter that said, we know what you did. We thank you for telling us about that. Please don't ever do that again. If you do it again, it could be a violation of the law. Mm-hmm. Virgil never got one of those warnings. Instead, he got arrested at an airport traveling on Thanksgiving Day to go see his family.
Well, hold on.
And then
a
he
second.
Had a nightmare.
Hold on a second. He did visit with the FBI. He did get questioned by the FBI for going to North Korea without permission. And I think by doing that, he got on the radar. And it took them months, because that happened earlier in the year. And then Thanksgiving, as you said, is when he was arrested. But had travel to North Korea not been a thing, he wouldn't have ever been on the radar in the first place, where they could have taken months to figure out what they could charge him with. And in this particular case, put him away for years. You know, I just think that when you when you have that kind of a travel restriction, it definitely makes it a lot harder to travel to that place, which I guess is the point. But I think that's really what caused him to be victimized here.
Oh, I think I see your point, right? So initially, that you're thinking that might have been what the FBI had in mind. I'm not sure. I don't know if that's the case. That could quite possibly be the case. I think they might have had sanctions issues in mind from the outset. I'm pretty sure that was the case as well, because it did seem like they focused on that, and that's ultimately where the case went. Mm-hmm. But it's just been what people also don't realize is that even though he was sentenced to 5 years and 3 months in prison, and we were able to reduce that, and he didn't spend that amount of time in prison, this has still been what is essentially a six-year saga for him. This started in 2019, and it's been very, very arduous, very difficult, very fraught. It has not been a cakewalk being over there. But I'm happy to say, too, that, you know, I have had the privilege and I think the very, very good fortune of being Virgil's lawyer throughout this process before he pleaded and then thereafter, and helping him with a lot of these post-conviction issues, navigate the system, file a motion to have himself resentenced in front of the judge, winning that motion, and dealing with a lot of his technical infrastructure that he had that was still, I think, in place for Ethereum and the Ethereum name.
Alex, you just self-muted.
Oh, there we are. But as part of this process, Virgil and I have really become quite close. We've become very, very good friends, and I consider the work that I've done for Virgil and seeing him come out today to just be one of the most awesome things that I've done in my legal career.
Yeah.
You know, every decade or so, you get some kind of reminder that you can do good things as a lawyer, and that you're part of a really noble profession, and that you have these really awesome powers to affect change. Today was one of those days, I have to say, that I'm really, really proud of being a lawyer.
And we all should be proud of your efforts, because no doubt it would be much, much worse had you not gotten involved. And it's just, you know, it strikes me to think how many other people are victims of the system in this way. We know Virgil, you know, we've known him for years. We're aware of how amazing a person he is, but he's certainly not the only one that is being victimized in this way. Rob, you had something. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm almost worried to ask this because it has the potential to bring the room down. But now that he's out, what can you tell us about the situation around his release, conditions, parole, that sort of thing?
Not too much right now. So at this moment, Virgil is probably still en route from Michigan down to Maryland, where he's going to be reporting to a halfway house, I believe tomorrow or the next day is when he needs to report there. At that point, he'll have to meet with a probation officer, I think it is, or somebody with the U.S. Probation Department. At that point, then we're going to know a little bit more about the terms and the conditions and the limitations of what he can and can't do. But until then, I think, you know, we can say, and this is one way that I think that was very apt how Virgil had put it, is that, look, the saga's not over here. You know, we're still going to have really burdensome probation requirements, reporting requirements. There'll be parole as well. There's also export restrictions that the Department of Commerce had placed on Virgil as a matter of course. Anybody who is convicted of violations that relate to sanctions have export restrictions placed on them. And these export restrictions are very burdensome. They actually relate to Virgil until 2032. So they were 10-year export restrictions, and they prevent Virgil from actually working on or creating anything that would be exported outside of the United States. And it prevents him from exporting anything made in the United States outside the United States
as well.
So
he came at a good time, because I think trade is kind of dead in this realm.
That's pretty funny. I'd never thought about the effect of the tariff wars on Virgil's Department of Commerce export restrictions. But sure, they might make things easier, especially if everything's homegrown nowadays. But I think that's going to be something tough. That's going to be something difficult to navigate. This is also why His father and I have been working behind the scenes for many months now, also to try to secure Virgil a pardon. And we've been front and center about that on social media and telling people about this. And this is something that's ongoing. We've made great progress towards a pardon for Virgil. And I think that it would be an exercise of the presidential pardon power that would be in this country's best interest, because this was a prosecution that I believe was wrongheaded and un-American from the outset. This is about speech. This is about curtailing speech. It's about preventing information about technology from being dispersed and disseminated, basically out of the mouth of an American citizen just because he happened to be in a foreign country. And I think that this was something that should not have happened. And so I think that we're going to continue to work towards hopefully securing some kind of presidential pardon for Virgil. It wouldn't make this all go away, but it would at least make some of the sting and the aftermath of this a lot more palatable.
All right. Well, let's hope that president is listening now because of what I'm about to say about the things that he's been up to over the past actually couple of hours. I don't know if you folks even heard about this. You remember the name Chris Krebs? That's the guy that served under the first Trump administration and was honest in his appraisal of the fact that there was no fraud, no significant fraud, certainly, in the 2020 election that propelled Joe Biden to the presidency. Well, today, Trump issued an executive order for him and security expert Miles Taylor to be investigated for treason. Folks, it's happening. it's turned into a witch hunt now against individuals that have wronged Trump in one way or another. Imagine an executive order asking the Department of Justice to basically probe these people and look into their being guilty, their possibly being guilty of treason. Treason, punishable by death. Yeah, this is what he said. Chris Krebs, this is a man who weaponized his position against free speech in the election context. The president further added that the order, quote, instructs your Department of Justice to investigate them. As for Taylor, he said, I think it's like a traitor. I don't know how he means that exactly. It's like spying. He wrote a book, Anonymous, and I always thought it was terrible. And now we have a chance to find out whether or not it was terrible. I don't even know what the hell he's saying. But the scary part about this is that this is a true weaponization of the Department of Justice, where individuals, citizens of this country, can be targeted by the most powerful person in the world for prosecution because he doesn't like what they said. It's what we've been warning everybody about for years now, and here it is finally happening. Anyone you know can be targeted. This is crazy. Now, Alex, does the Department of Justice have to do this? Can they refuse?
I think they can refuse. I think if they refuse, though, they're very likely going to be subject to termination, and they'll find somebody that will investigate them. I'm just learning about this now and reading about it now as you mentioned this, Emmanuel. This is totally insane.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is really, really scary. I mean, this is also what's, I think, most frightening about this. This is what Trump promised he would do.
Mm-hmm.
He would go after his political rivals in this respect.
But this isn't a political rival. This is simply a person who was asked, was there fraud, and said no. That's it.
Yeah, that may be the case, but saying no makes you a political rival to Trump. This is a classic case of perception is reality here. The president's perception of his political rivals are the people whom he's prosecuting now. That's terrifying,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, it doesn't even have to sound an objective fact here, whether you're a political operative or not. This is somebody who was a federal official who opined on objective facts and now is the subject and target of an executive order, and it also looks like it's targeting his company and removing the security clearances from the company that's employing him. But I think is that correct as well? I think it's Sentinel One or something like that. I'm just kind of getting up to speed here. But this is a total weaponization, I think, not even of the Department of Justice. This is a weaponization of the executive office of the president. That's really something that the American people should not be countenancing.
Now, we've seen the reaction that very big companies, very powerful companies, have had when being threatened. We've seen how state governments have responded, not here in New York, fortunately, but in other states. We've seen how various universities have responded to intimidation tactics. And the thing I notice is that they're very quick to cave. And I can only imagine, in the case of these two individuals, any connections they have, any companies they're affiliated with, are also going to cave because they're scared to death. And that is where the true harm comes in. This can just go nowhere, and their careers could be destroyed. They could be living in fear for now, maybe for the rest of their lives. We're seeing the same thing, certainly, with immigrants, people holding green cards, people here legally. I'm not even talking about people who aren't here legally. There is so much fear now, and it's having an effect on who we are. It's having an effect on how we live our lives. Now, you know, this last weekend was great because a million people turned out throughout the country to oppose this crap. But that's just the first step. It's got to grow from there if anything is going to come of it. I mean, can you imagine? This guy, or these two people, were considered enemies of the state by Trump. What do you think WBAI is thought of when we're on the air 24/7 critiquing one thing or another, revealing one thing or another, and basically being a pain in the ass to anybody who's in a position of authority? And we've been doing that since 1960. If that's not a reason to go to WBAI.org right now and pledge to keep this place going, I can't think of any other reason I'd ever be able to come up with. Go ahead, Rob.
Yeah, just confirming from other sources I'm looking at here, the security clearance for Chris Krebs, which has been revoked, includes any given to staff at the company Sentinel One, where Krebs is currently working. And this also revokes the clearance of DHS official Miles Taylor, ex-DHS official Miles Taylor, and it also includes any security clearance for individuals at the University of Pennsylvania, where Taylor is a lecturer, according to the White House, pending a review of whether such clearances are consistent with the national interest. So this isn't going just after two people. This is going after a huge swath of people with nothing to do with this.
Absolutely, absolutely. And the fear and intimidation it's planting in all of us, you know, it will basically be a deciding factor if somebody wants to go into this line of work. They will think about what they say, what they do, because of what could happen to them. All theoretical. But that is really where the intimidation comes in. And, you know, this is just one instance, one example. I mean, Trump fired the head of the National Security Agency. Think about that. Think about what that means. This happened last week. Fired Timothy Howe, the head of the National Security Agency, and Cyber Command. It's, you know, just because, what's her, who's that lunatic he's been hanging out with lately?
Laura Loomer.
I mean, she's, I will say it, she's out of her mind, and he talks to her once, and she convinces him to fire the head of the NSA.
Right, and imagine, given his track record with replacing many of the people that he fires, who will he come up with, either as an interim solution or as someone that will be there on a permanent basis beyond even his term? Like, the level of quality that he comes up with is so doubtful to me. Maybe someone can prove otherwise, but I don't imagine they will be very well credentialed, or at least if they are, I don't know they'll have a lot of our interests in mind.
Oh, what, the people? No, of course not. We're not even on the radar here.
What radar? They got rid of that.
You know, you would think we'd be talking about Trump tanking the stock market, but no, that's actually in the back page now. Everything is. You know, I did see something in the New York Times today, though, which, you know, for those of you interested in studying media and its biases and things like that, basically, I think it was the S&P index, whatever that is. I don't know the first thing about any of it. They said they had their best day today since 2008. And the best day after all the crashes and all the numbers went down into smaller numbers, you know, it made me think. Okay, try this analogy. You light a match to your house and you're burning your damn house down, and then you decide, you know what, I'm not going to burn my house down, and you put it out, and now your house is half burned down. Is that a good day? The day that your house stopped burning down? I mean, is that the best day since 2008?
No,
you still have half a house that's burned down. It's not a good day.
I was thinking you take all of your money and you burn all your money, and then
oh, that's good too.
You walk down the street and you find a nickel on the ground. You say you had your best day since you lost all your money.
And you burned it yourself. That's good. I like that one better. Okay, analogy time, folks. So write to us, oth@2600.com, if you have an analogy for what the hell is going on out there. And also, you know, there's another story. I think, Rob, you found this one about what YouTube has done, also out of fear. YouTube, owned by Google, they quietly scrubbed the phrase gender identity and expression from its public-facing hate speech policy, prompting concern from LGBTQ plus advocates who warn the change removes clarity around protections for transgender and non-binary users. But according to the company, in true Orwellian style, there is no change to policy. Now, I don't know how you can erase words from a policy and then say there's no change to the policy. They say, though, our hate speech policies haven't changed. They said they told this to the reporter. This is according to a user mag story. But clearly those words are gone. So, a spokesperson for GLAAD told The Advocate of the larger implications of YouTube's actions should concern everyone. When a company or political leaders decide that certain groups of people are to be seen as less than others, it too often results in real-world harm. YouTube and other platforms should be protecting LGBTQ creators and users during a time when right-wing extremists and others are seeking to harm them. You shouldn't be taking away words. You should be adding words, because there are a lot more potential victims here. I really would like to know the logic, though. We haven't changed anything. You took the words out. They're not there anymore. How is that not a change?
Yeah, I hear they've also raised the chocolate ration to 20 grams, so that's exciting.
Oh, good. Thank you. Thank you for that glorious bit of news.
You can always bet on the insecurities of straight men.
All right. Elon Musk. I haven't talked about Elon Musk enough yet. Elon Musk-led team. No, this is how we say it now. The Elon Musk-led team, known as the Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, has rolled out AI to monitor workers' communications for perceived anti-Trump sentiment. That's according to Reuters. That's not according to some paranoid crazy person yelling in the street. No, that's according to Reuters, who actually might be crazy people in the street right now. looking for anti-Trump sentiment, using AI to find it. The technology is already being used at the Environmental Protection Agency, run by well-known fascist Lee Zeldin. The move marks an extraordinary use of technology to identify expressions of perceived disloyalty in a workforce already upended by widespread firings, according to Reuters. DOGE had this to say. Nothing. They said nothing. That's what I meant.
How would you know if...
I just wanted that to sink in.
If a leader was bad, like, there's no fail-safe for this, right? If the leader becomes bad to these disciples, how would they even know if there was a critique, if you're scrubbing any kind of discourse?
Well, a simple answer to that, Kyle. The leader can't become bad.
Right, but what if they become bad?
But that's not possible, Kyle.
No, I know that's not possible, but in the event that they become bad over time, not now when they can't ever become bad, but later, after this time, the later time when they become bad, and you're a disciple and you're like, I don't like the bad, how do you even know if you put these things in place? I just don't see the engineering prowess here.
I am perceiving disloyalty, Kyle.
I'm perceiving disloyalty,
and I'm not even artificial intelligence.
No, I'm loyal to the idea that you want to know if something has gone wrong, especially if it never goes wrong. That's fine if it never goes wrong, but in the event that it does, how do you know?
I'm coming to the conclusion that none of us would make good federal workers, like, ever. Go ahead, Gila.
Probably not. I mean, I'm assuming someday they have bagels at the EPA office, and then the following week someone writes in about the orange juice went bad, and everyone on that email gets fired because they heard orange, they heard bad, they made certain assumptions.
Yeah, okay.
It's AI, man. Nobody knows.
Okay, so that's scary. That is just damn scary that is what people who work for the government are being faced with right now. Now, the government may have always been able to look at your email if you're a government employee, says Sarah Block, a partner at employment law firm McGillivray Steel Elkin. She said this to Fortune magazine. I think agencies were not doing that. They could, but they weren't, as far as looking at emails. But now the stakes are higher. And the willingness to skirt laws is brazen. And referring to government skirting laws of privacy and things like that. It's a prohibited personnel practice to discriminate against someone for partisan political reasons. It's essentially political discrimination. Yeah, that's what we're looking at. Rob?
That sounds about right. I mean, has there ever been a rule spelled out on the books that you had to like the president to be a federal worker, to be a good federal worker even? I can't imagine that it has, but the idea now that this is just, okay, this has been laid out in hard-coded algorithms, this is terrifying, and everyone should be terrified, whatever side of whatever you might be on.
I think that actually has me thinking about the staying power of systems like this. So if you're installing this kind of mechanism, imagine a regime following, of course, our system of elections in how little real fraud there is in our election system. Let's assume we have a wonderful election and a regime that you don't necessarily like. Let's say, I don't know, one that's more blue than your liking comes into power and has access to these same things. They don't go away
exactly
from one place to another. So, and here I don't want to get too philosophical or like quasi-religious, but this is that like my comfort with paradox where like we are in hell, but we also can create a sort of heaven or utopia, but it's through action and that dual, like that push and pull, like their idea of utopia in government has all of these things cleansing it, so to speak, but when those are reprogrammed and retooled but implemented in exactly the same way, does not their utopia become a sort of waking hell implemented by a perhaps bluer regime? That's the thing, that like they're installing all this stuff. It's like if they put in like fire sprinklers that also had like their favorite soda or something, like, and they didn't, and then they like they decided maybe okay, we actually don't need fire sprinklers, we're just gonna have soda or like, I don't know, cotton candy or something. Some crazy thing gets put in under one regime, then it comes back to bite you when you actually need it to do the thing or not be, let's say, complicated in this way. I don't know if that's actually an analogy. We're going crazy with analogies this hour. But I just find it interesting that they find themselves so clever in installing these things, they don't realize that the very same sorts of impacts that Democrats might be decrying and being upset about, or that we're pointing out, really changes the nonpartisanship of government employees, will come back in if these things aren't removed. And many times the technology, the technology stays, can be retooled and reprogrammed and become something that eliminates their voices in what should be nonpartisan positions.
This is an excellent point because, and we've said this many, many times, it doesn't go away. When something is developed that's intrusive, the next regime, even if it's diametrically opposed to everything the current regime stands for, they'll keep that technology. They won't give it back. They won't disconnect it, and it'll become a permanent part of our society, and it'll become something that appears normal. Think of kids today. You know, to them, surveillance is completely normal, and it was not when people our age, or my age at least, were growing up. And when something becomes normalized, you might be surprised that something you feel is outrageous is no big thing anymore. And that's somewhat sad. Alex, go ahead.
Yeah, there are distinct federal laws on the books right now that really restrict political activities with respect to federal employees. You know, this is something when I was a federal employee that I was schooled on, especially because I had worked in defense and intelligence, but it's something called the Hatch Act. It prevents you from wearing things like political buttons or it's questionable whether sometimes you can drive a car with a political bumper sticker into a certain federal employee parking lot without violating the Hatch Act. I mean, there are all these guidelines and parameters about what you can and cannot do politically as a federal employee that have been in place for many, many, many years now. And in fact, there's even restrictions on what certain types of federal employees can do even outside of the federal workforce. So if you work at CIA, FBI, or NSA, you're actually barred from any active participation in partisan campaigns. Like, that's how serious the Hatch Act is taken in the federal workforce. And these types of activities really just make a mockery of federal law that's been on the book for decades.
Well, I think a lot of laws or habits are being made mockeries of in recent days, weeks, even years. And I don't know where it's going to go from here. But I'm really kind of shaken by the story of people being investigated for treason who have differed with Trump. It's going to extend to members of Congress, former holders of the office of president for sure, and common citizens, people that we know. That is what we are looking at right now. So we have to stick together. We have to not back down like the big companies are doing. And we've got to be their biggest nightmare. Massive pains in the ass that are always out there and always one step ahead. I think that's really, the only hope that this this country has at this point. We only have 2 minutes. And Alex, are you smoking a cigarette, Alex? My God, I've never seen you do that. I haven't seen you do that in like 10 years. Is it that bad?
Hey, so,
well, maybe it's a cigarette. I don't know.
Oh, okay. Well, it depends. But all right. In the last minute and a half that we have, any final words on Virgil? Because that's the good news. That's the news I'd like to leave the show with, is that Virgil is finally free.
Yeah, Virgil is finally free after a 6-year ordeal. He still has hurdles to jump through. This is certainly not the end of it. But as he himself has said, the board is in a different position now, and we're in much more control of the pieces. He's in more control over his life. He has freedom. He can go out to eat things. He told me today that it felt like he was waiting to be reborn when coming out of prison, and that the outside world was very, very high stimuli for him. So this is, I expect great things to come from Virgil. He's done great things in the past. He's a thinker. He's a doer. This is exactly the kind of person that we're proud to have as part of the hacker community, that we're proud to have as part of the blockchain community, and we're proud to have working with us in the future to make this world better.
About that outside world, I hope it's not too much of a shock what we're giving him at this point. Rob, quickly.
Is there a way for people who want to send Virgil a nice message of support to do that?
Well, at this moment, we have not publicly released any details of his address yet, but I think that people should check back here regularly. Listen to WBAI. Listen to us next week.
Okay.
And email us. Have more.
And we basically are out for tonight, but we have overtime coming up on YouTube. Go to Channel 2600 on YouTube or check the link on the front page of 2600.com. Next week, we'll be doing a call-in show here on WBAI, so that's always fun. Mark your calendars for that.
Don't be afraid of your freedom. Free like a bee. He's gonna rescue me from my granddaddy.